Good morning and welcome to the Sussex County Council meeting of November 16, 2021. First things, you approve the agenda. Mr. Lawson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Good morning, members of council. I do see one recommended change to today's agenda. We can strike at the 1:30 public hearings conditional use 2272 Charles Stanley. That application has been withdrawn.
Entertained a motion to approve the agenda as amended.
So moved.
Motion, Mr. Riley.
Second.
Second, Mr. Schaefer. Any questions on the motion? Take the vote, Mr. Schaefer.
Yes.
Mr. Green.
Yes.
Mr. Hudson.
Yes.
Mr. Riley.
Yes.
I will yes. Motion carried. At the minutes of November the 9th, any questions, corrections, additions? Hearing none, those stand approved. Reading the correspondence, Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have a letter from Westside New Beginnings, Inc., West Rehoboth Children and Youth Program, thanking Sussex County Council for its grant from the Human Services Grant. And that
you,
is
sir.
All.
Any correspondence from council? Correspondence from council. Okay, now is the time for public comment. Anybody in the audience wishes to speak? You have 3 minutes to speak on something that the council has some control over or interest in. Anybody want to speak? Anybody in the audience want to speak? Okay. Operator, would you check online, please?
At this time, there's no one on the line.
Thank you. We'll close public comments. We have one item on the consent agenda, an existing sewer infrastructure use agreement, IUA-867-1, Asselman Lakes, Evergreen RPC, Miller Creek area. Any questions on that? Not entertaining a motion to approve the consent agenda.
So moved.
Motion, Mr. Riley.
Second.
Second, Mr. Hudson. Any questions on the motion? Take the vote, Mr. Schaefer.
Yes.
Mrs. Green.
Yes.
Mr. Hudson.
Yes.
Mr. Riley.
Yes.
I vote yes. Next is our friend Mark Isaacs, director of the Caravelle Resource Education Center. Morning, sir.
Good morning. Morning. Good morning, council and key team members. It's always a pleasure to come here. Welcome, Cynthia and Mark. I haven't had the pleasure of meeting you in person. So I'm Mark Isaacs, and I'm the director of the University of Delaware's Albert N. and Ann V. Carville Research and Education Center. That's a big, long title, I know. But I get the privilege of always coming to the council each year and talking to the council members about how we spend the funds that the council provides to support our agriculture and outreach extension programs. So that's what I wanted to take a little bit of a few minutes of your time to explain and answer any questions that you all may have. So for those of you that may not know exactly what the center does, we're really the Southern Agriculture Experiment Station for the University of Delaware College of Ag and Natural Resources. And we're very unique in the fact that a lot of ag experiment stations don't possess all three of a university's land grant missions, which is teaching, research, and outreach and extension. So we do all three of those legs at our facility. Myself and others actually teach courses out of there, agriculture courses. We have students that are in the associate arts program that attend at Dell Tech. Matter of fact, this year I have 11 students that's in my class that I teach. I teach a course called Understanding Today's Agriculture. And then we network with main campus students. So it's using interactive video conferencing, which pre-COVID was a pretty cool way, but I think a lot of our students are pretty tired of seeing somebody's face on the TV screen anymore. But it is in person, so I go back and forth. Our station has a long history of providing critical support for our 4-H and youth development programs, all of our county agricultural programs, which include field crops and vegetable crops. And of course, our poultry industry, which we have a poultry diagnostic laboratory that's located there on our facility. We do all the poultry disease surveillance testing for the state of Delaware, parts of Maryland, and even Eastern Shore, Virginia. We're actually doing some testing for one of the integrators from North Carolina as well. It's a nationally known lab, state-of-the-art facility that the state of Delaware provided renovation funds for back in 2016. The council has always been tremendous in supporting everything that we do out of there, which is pretty critical because, you know, at a university level, a lot of times things are governed from main campus. And I can tell you now, and I always tell the council here, every penny that the county supports in this program stays in the county. Nothing goes above the canal. It's all to support all of our county programs. And I'm really proud of that. I've been with the university for 35 years. I know I don't look that old, right? But for discussion, right? But so we have our 4-H Youth Development Program. We have all of our county extension programs there, which is agriculture, horticulture. We have our poultry extension program that's run out of our facility. I mentioned our poultry diagnostic lab. We also have a poultry facility that's pretty unique. We're only two east of the Mississippi River. It's called the Jones Hamilton Environmental Poultry House. It's a great opportunity where a company, Jones Hamilton from Ohio, approached us, and we got state funding, and actually the council has supported activities in that, and it's where we do kind of environmental quality research in that house, looking at emissions of the poultry house and how we can improve litter management. Activities within the poultry house, how we can make the environment a lot better while we're still producing, of course, one of our most critical agricultural commodities. The other thing that's really awesome that the council's done that really every year I get an opportunity to thank the council for is they've provided funds that have been specific for field crop research. A lot of times we'll get funds from some of the companies and allied industries, but they're kind of directed at evaluating products of their own. Mm-hmm. And the funds that the council gives us allows us to target problems that our producers are facing in the field, aka nematodes, which is a soil pest, some variety testing, some nutrient management, some irrigation work that we do. All of that is really kind of specific to our soil types and our climate that we have here in Sussex. So we also have, there's about 57,500 that goes towards our extension programs that I mentioned. We have about 13,000 that goes towards our poultry research and diagnostic efforts. We have about 18,000 roughly that goes towards our field crops, Sussex field crops research. And we have about 10,000 that the council provides that goes towards our safety programs that supports all of our activities around making sure that what we're doing in the agricultural sector is highlighted and safety is of paramount importance. And then one of the greatest things that I really love, because I love working with kids, is the council gives $10,000 a year to support internship programs. And these are, this has been historical that the council's done this, and it's allowed us to work with students that are interested in agriculture and placing them in work-based learning opportunities throughout the summer. You know, once they get that piece of paper, it's all about what are they going to do with it and what kind of impact are they going to have. And it's been unbelievable. It's allowed us to really expand offerings, especially, and it's earmarked for kids that are residents of Sussex County. So it only goes to support Sussex County students. And we've had students from Del Tech. We've had students that are in the Associate Arts program. And it's also been a great opportunity that some of these employers have, after the students have done their internship, have elected to hire them the following summer. So, of course, we've been doing it. We don't have any that have graduated with 4 years yet and been hired yet. But obviously, that's our goal is, once the students graduate from the university, that they get hired by the company that's providing the internship at times for them. So with that, I'll take any questions that the council may have. But the $109,000 that you provide annually is really critical, and I can't thank you all enough for the support. And it's something that, along with the state, has allowed us to really grow our programs and maintain the support of our number one industry in the state.
I think, Mark, that you certainly your staff out there and your facility does a great job for this county, because certainly ag is our number one industry. And I know this council and previous council have always been very strong about how we can help to keep it that way. Right. And training young people to maybe stay here and work on whatever else is a great thing. So I know we certainly appreciate all you doing out there, and I think it's money well spent of the taxpayer dollars to support ag in this county. So, any questions of council? Mr. Hudson.
COVID.
Yes, great question.
You guys weathering it? Okay.
Yes, sir. So, great question. So, obviously, everybody's dealt with the impacts and still dealing with it with COVID. I was just telling Michael, our field research staff, our poultry diagnostic staff, and our facility maintenance staff never missed a day.
That's awesome.
We never shut that down because you can't shut research down. Our cooperative extension staff worked remotely, and they're kind of working in a hybrid environment right now. I will tell you that I stood some firm ground with those in Newark that wanted things to happen otherwise. But I told them, as long as I'm here, this is how we're doing it. And so we never shut down. Because if you do that, you're ultimately impacting multi-year projects, and you're affecting funding sources. The big impact that it really had on us was the internship. We had to shut things down last year. But I was telling Michael, the good news in that is that everybody's eager, and I think at this point we may have 4 interns this summer.
Good deal.
So we'll probably double the amount of interns that we usually get. We generally get 2 interns a summer. Because it's roughly, that's the amount of money that we use to support them. And, a lot of places will offer work-based learning opportunities for students, but they don't pay them. And in today's time, that's not good for these kids, because a lot of these kids are having, to pay for their education and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, to be honest with you, I've always taken the platform that if we can't get these students some paying work-based learning opportunities, then we're failing. So that's the nice thing. And I will tell you this for the new council members. The great thing that what the council has done in providing those sources has allowed us to piggyback and build relationships with allied industries. So we've got internships with Willard's Agrochemical, with Helena, with Southern States. So we're building allied industry internships, and it started right here with the council supporting that. So, that's another neat thing about the funds that y'all provided. It's allowed me to stand in front of groups and say, look, we got our own county that's supporting this. We need you guys to step up to the plate. So we're continually, I think we've run all the interns together since we've been doing this program the last 4 or 5 years. I think we've run about 40 interns through that, not just from the county funds. I'm talking about all the funds together.
Do the interns all come out of the program in Newark?
No. We've got, matter of fact, a lot of them are here in the Associate Arts program. So they're not even ag majors yet, but they're interested in ag, which has actually served as a recruiting tool for these kids. Because, matter of fact, I've got 11 students in my class right now that are from the Associate Arts and 14 in main campus. And of the 11 that are coming out to Carville in our class, 6 of those have expressed interest in going to main campus to study agriculture. So that's awesome.
Good.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping
for. I got a question.
Mr. Ryan.
Do you see any new opportunities for farmers out there? I mean, we're always trying to diversify, what we can produce and looking for opportunities to make some money. Are there anything new out there on the horizon that you see as an opportunity?
As far as cropping systems, you mean, or revenue generators?
Revenue generators. I mean, not necessarily agritourism, but new crops that might work, animal husbandry, initiatives, things like that.
So, great question. So, a lot of the we call them small farmettes. Mm-hmm. They're looking at growing goats for certain populations. They become very prominent in their meat selection.
Right.
So that's been a nice little niche. Some backyard comb farmettes. There's also been interest in, and this kind of piggies a little bit on the agritourism part of it, but specialty crops, vegetables, some herbs, some unique crops that are, again, kind of culture market oriented. A lot of roughages, a lot of greens that have become of interest in for the Asian markets. So that's been nice. As far as the grain crops, one thing I think last time I was here with y'all, there has been an interest with industrial hemp. And looking, the poultry industry has actually expressed an interest in looking at alternative litter, which right now they use pond shavings,
right,
which is very costly. And but there's still a lot of hoops that have to be jumped through. When it first came out, and the Farm Bill came out and allowed for industrial hemp, in which those of you that may not be familiar with, it's there was a lot of animosity against that because of marijuana, but they're two different products. Industrial hemp has less than 0.3% THC content, whereas hemp is, you know, marijuana is anywhere from 15 to up. And so they were looking at it for an alternative fiber source, and one of the vegetable processing company was actually looking at setting up a processor to be able to contract with growers like they were doing in Kentucky and the Carolinas. The problem was there wasn't a market yet identified. And what happened down south is that's what kind of caused a lot of producers to go to get in some financial straits. The good thing is that our Secretary of Ag, Michael Skuse, and I was working with the Department of Ag a lot on this in the outreach piece, we were telling the producers, you know, you got to be very careful in this right now. Main thing is you have to identify a market and make sure that it's fluid and that you've got a way, because you can grow it, but what are you going to do with it? And that's kind of what happened. I do think there's promise for that. It's just getting the bugs worked out. We have been doing some insect and some weed and some disease work a little bit with it, with some of those that have elected, and you've got to apply through the Department of Ag to get a permit to grow this. Anyway, and it's on a small scale. So that does, looking longer term, probably offer a possibility, especially that would support the poultry industry and the litter.
Right.
Piece of that.
How about like marketing the specialty crops, like you mentioned herbs and things like that? Do you guys assist with some of these farmettes and their marketing efforts?
Another great question. So we just did hire a ag marketing extension agent position, and he's actually starting January 1st coming out of Virginia. He worked for North Carolina Cooperative Extension, and then he went to work for a private firm where they were doing, name it, tobacco products, specialty market. And we're really excited about having him, because prior to that we didn't have anybody, especially down here, and the position is going to be located at Carville,
okay,
which is another great thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's always the challenge.
Yes,
yeah.
It's the marketing piece,
right.
Exactly.
Right.
And we really didn't have, like I said, we didn't have the skill set for somebody that could just focus on that. We can grow it, but you got to be able to market it.
Right. Last thing, we all have been hearing about the biogas effort,
right,
over in Blades. Do you have any point of view on that as to, you know, is it a good idea? How do you feel about the safety aspect of it? Or I don't know if you want to weigh in or not, but I'm just going to throw it out there.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I think it's always great to be open-minded and looking at alternative, you know, in particular when it's coming to energy, right? I know enough about it to be dangerous, and so not enough to make a pro-yay or nay comment. I will tell you that a lot of our agriculture producers were concerned about the use of the poultry manure that they're using for their cropping systems, and making sure that they had the availability to be able to continue to use those. A great case in point, if you've been following the price of nitrogen.
Right.
So I farm too, by the way. I'm a grain farmer, fourth generation grain farmer too. Nitrogen went from about 47 cents to now it's over a dollar. So all of our input costs have really skyrocketed in the last 7 months. And this is, again, going to create a challenge, because the nice thing about the poultry manure is it's used It enhances the soil health, improves the organic matter, which in turn improves moisture holding capacity, provides nitrogen and phosphorus and a lot of micronutrients that are needed for grain and vegetable crops. So there's always, when you talk about alternative energy, you've always, as you all are aware in your roles, you've always got two different sides. But I do think it's always good to look at how there can be some linkages and some mergers, because at the end of the day, you know, we're going to have to change a lot of things we're doing to feed. In 2050, we're talking about providing food and fiber for about 9.5 billion people worldwide. And we're not growing any more land. So, right, and we're going to have to do it in an environmentally sustainable mechanism and do it that it's going to allow, you know, the next generation to come in and have great career opportunities in that. But they're great questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
I will say I went to a meeting about a couple months ago in Wilmington, got invited up there. It was about industrial hemp. And then I came back and talked to Mr. Lawson, and we discovered someone in Sussex County is growing industrial hemp indoors.
Yes.
So we learned something. So
yes.
It's here.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And we have some that's the small plots that have been outside. Last year, the permitting went down really, but the interest in permitting, because what happened the year before, everybody got into it, and it's kind of like everything else, and everybody gets into it.
Right,
you know, yeah. Things go south, and then they found out that they didn't have a market for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of what we were kind of counseling them to be careful of. But
sure.
We're still in the learning phase of it, too, because to be honest with you, we've never done any kind of research with it. So we're still learning.
Sure.
You know.
One last question. Interns.
Yes.
If, I hate to say this, if we gave you some more money,
yes,
would you have to go to have more interns? Do you have
absolutely.
People that you're not getting in the program because they have not lack of resources?
I think there's great opportunities in that.
Okay.
Now, last year, like I said, you know, was a different game changer. And to be honest with you, and you know me, you've worked around me long enough, you know, I'm very frugal when it comes to managing our county funds, because I appreciate it, because I'm a county taxpayer too. So, but I do think there's great opportunities to expand that. Right now, if I can expand these internship programs with the partnerships with Allied Industries, that's a win-win.
Sure.
And it's saving our county money. But yeah, I think we're going to get to a point. Like I said, we've had well over 40 interns, and that's not just the county funds,
sure.
But in what we've done, and I see it really, because to be honest with you, and especially coming off of COVID, you know, the impacts now that we're seeing with these students is really this work-based learning. You know, the not saying that textbooks aren't good, I'm not saying that, but you know, we've got to teach these young minds ways to interact with people, ways to deal with conflict resolution, way to adapt to success and failures, and they're not getting that in the classroom.
Sure.
You know, so the more we can put them in a work-based environment is going to be better.
I agree. Well,
thank you very much for all you do, buddy. We appreciate it.
And thank you all so very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lawson.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm going to pass a document down. First item of business is the 2022 council meeting schedule and holiday schedule. It is that time of year where council reviews our schedule for the upcoming year and sets that schedule. There's information in the packet this week related to our holiday schedule. And I'm passing down the little cheat sheet that I produce each year that illustrates for us the days that we are scheduled to have council meetings, days we will observe holidays, as well as other job-related items that we need to schedule for, like our budget workshops, budget week, when NACO is hosting their conferences. And of course, next year is an election year, so we are observing primary day as well as election and return day, which is historically something the county has done. I did list in the packet the days that we are following for our holiday schedule. I'll highlight them now. Those include, and these are the traditional days that we have followed in years past, New Year's Day, Martin Luther King Day, Good Friday, Memorial Day, Juneteenth, Independence Day, Labor Day, Election Day, Return Day, Veterans Day, Thanksgiving, and Christmas. Unless there are any other questions, I do have a motion for your consideration.
Any questions of council? Please read your motion, sir.
Thank you. Be it moved, the Sussex County Council approves the 2022 county holiday schedule and the 2022 county meeting schedule as presented.
Pleasure, council.
Move for adoption.
Motion, Mr. Hudson.
Second.
Second, Mr. Riley. Any questions on the motion? Take the vote. Mr. Schaefer.
Yes.
Mrs. Green.
Yes.
Mr. Hudson.
Yes.
Mr. Riley.
Yes.
I will yes. Motion carried. Next, sir.
Thank you. And next, County Administrator's Report for November 16th. Item 1, the Sussex County Engineering Department will be conducting a public hearing on the proposed boundary for the Indian River Acres area of the Sussex County Unified Sanitary Sewer District on Saturday, November 20th, starting at 9 a.m. This meeting will take place at the Community Lutheran Church at 30897 Omar Road in Frankfort. Item 2, Council will not meet next Tuesday, November 23rd, during the week of Thanksgiving. County offices will be closed Thursday, November 25th, and Friday, November 26th for the Thanksgiving holiday, and will reopen Monday, November 29th at 8:30. The next regularly scheduled council meeting will be held Tuesday, November 30th at 10 a.m. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, sir. Next, Randy Dolman, Housing Trust Fund update. Good morning.
Thank you. Morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
So,
thank you.
I'm back before you this morning to provide a brief update on the Housing Trust Fund. When I was here in July, I presented a framework, a potential framework for the Housing Trust Fund based on recommendations from the LSA planning study and input from council. At that meeting, I indicated that I would present that framework to stakeholders and potential applicants and housing advocates to ensure that it would adequately address the affordability gap related to the development and purchase of affordable housing. So in late September, I convened a small group of stakeholders to discuss the proposed components of the Housing Trust Fund, and today I wanted to share some of their feedback and discuss next steps. So this is just a brief recap of the initial proposed framework that was presented to you in July. As you recall, as part of the FY 2022 budget, Sussex County Council approved $500,000 to create a housing trust fund, and we proposed to split that into two components. One arm would be a development loan fund of $400,000, and the other would be a direct homebuyer assistance with $100,000, and there would be the creation of an advisory board to help oversee funding approvals for the development fund. So again, this is just part of the original proposal. This is something that would be accessible by affordable housing providers and other nonprofits. They would be available once a year, up to $100,000 or $10,000 per unit would be the application budget. The funding source is the initial amount provided by Sussex County Council. The repayments would be returned on principal to create a revolving fund. It's a five-year loan with 0% interest, and there would be long-term affordability restrictions for rental and homebuyer-assisted projects. So the advisory board would again assist with reviewing and evaluating any applications for the fund, making sure they align with our established goals and objectives. The idea would be to address pre-development costs, and the goal is to basically provide that bridge and gap financing for these projects to make sure they're actually feasible and to give Sussex County some teeth in the game, because we want to make sure that we're involved and sort of help provide some leverage for this development here in the county. The other arm, again, is the home buyer assistance, and this would be handled internally by my office, Community Development and Housing. We were hoping to address our assist households earning up to 120% of the area median income, and the funds would be used for down payment and closing cost, and it must be a primary residence, that sort of thing. And it's for a $10,000 per household soft second loan. It's a 10-year recapture period, which means that if for some reason someone were to sell their home in 5 years, they would owe us the five-year balance or 50%, $5,000 of that loan, and those funds would go back into the pot for reuse. Okay, and so at the stakeholder meeting, we had just a small group and had a pretty great conversation about all of the things I just discussed. And overall, there was strong support for the Housing Trust Fund and appreciation for the council's motivation to take action on the affordable housing issue. The Development Fund generated the most conversation, for sure. There was definitely a preference for grants over the loan, which is what we've proposed. They did agree that pre-development cost is where assistance would be welcome. The $10,000 per unit, $100,000 per project, they felt was insufficient for some of these multi-million dollar projects that are sometimes proposed through tax credits and other funding sources. They also expressed a need for flexibility on when payments are to be repaid in the event there are delays or other issues in the project. And then basically they commented on the generation of a future funding availability and funding source. So the discussion of a sustainable and dedicated funding source like a fee or tax. And then of course ARPA funding was brought up as well. So it was suggested that the ARPA funds could be used to increase and expand the Housing Trust Fund, that they would allow for additional dollars to potentially allow for grants versus loans, increase the amount of funding that could be available per project, and would allow for deeper subsidies, which would access lower income households. On the home buyer side, the feedback that we received was that they wanted to see us targeting even lower household incomes. So if you recall, we had initially proposed 120% AMI or less, which that's the bottom highlighted dollar amounts there. So that would be for a family of four, $90,120 versus $60,100 at the 80% level. They also recommended that the $10,000 be increased to a minimum of $25,000 with a preference to $50,000 per household to assist with down payment and closing costs given the current market climate and competitive nature of the real estate market. And they recommended requiring home buyer counseling, which is already a component of our neighborhood stabilization program. And again, ARPA funding would expand the trust fund and allow for increased amounts available to households of lower incomes. So we have an extremely active and supportive affordable housing advocacy network here in Sussex County, and I'm very appreciative for their willingness to offer feedback and to participate in the development of this trust fund. And we don't want to implement an initiative that will be underutilized or even worse, not utilized at all. So with that said, I wanted to propose some potential adjustments to the framework in response to the feedback that was received from the stakeholders. For the development fund, I'd like to recommend maintaining the revolving fund loan fund concept, but to revisit the grant concept when and if it's determined that ARPA funds may be used for trust fund expansion. And I do want to note that although we are piloting a loan fund, it is a loan at 0% interest, and one with significantly less red tape than other financial institutions are offering. I'd like to increase the flexibility for applications to exceed the $100,000 cap with sufficient support and proven capacity. So the idea with this trust fund is to be a flexible source of bridge and gap financing. So being able to offer a flexible award system would be ideal. For example, a smaller nonprofit that is only pursuing a project with one or two homeownership units may only need a $50,000 loan to bridge their financing gap. But a larger nonprofit that has a $10 million plus project with multi-layered financing may need, you know, upwards of $200,000 or more to fill the gap. So this would just allow us to have that flexibility when awarding these loans. And I think, but it should be noted that by offering this flexibility, it will reduce during the pilot year. It could result in fewer projects being funded if we increase that amount. We would recommend to defer the loan payments for 1 year after receipt of the funds. So the first payment would not be due until an entire year after the funds are received initially. And, and I think we need to align the application with other funding cycles. Originally, we had hoped to make this funding available in early January, but it seems like the recommendation is to coordinate with some other funding cycles to be early spring, which would be March and April. And we can make this even more flexible in the future if we feel like we need to even offer the application more than one time a year to align with those cycles, we could consider that. The homebuyer assistance, I definitely am supportive of lowering that target household income from 120% AMI down to 80% AMI. I would like to maintain the $10,000 per household for the pilot year, just to get a sense of what kind of applications we receive and to see if they do warrant the increase of additional dollars per household. And then we can explore that next year as, you know, we're already close to that grant or towards the budget season, and we can have that conversation. So if anyone has any feedback about that, all of that, before I go to the next item.
Anybody? Any comments from Randy, questions? That's a lot to take in right now.
Yeah.
There could be questions.
Okay. I have one more item. So to finish, I wanted to propose my recommended slate of advisory board members for the Housing Trust Fund for the initial pilot year. Gina Jennings, myself, Bill Poff, our Economic Development Director, Sarah Ryan, and Amy Walls. And I wanted to just read a brief bio for each of the two outside participants, just so you have a reference of where they're coming from. Sarah Ryan is a graduate of Temple University and University of Maryland School of Law. Before going to law school, she worked in community development in Philadelphia. She has worked as an attorney at the Homeless Persons Representation Project, representing chronically homeless individuals, Disability Rights Maryland in the Mental Health Unit, and Maryland Legal Aid, running a program for self-represented litigants in Maryland courts. She has also taught at Delaware Technical Community College in the English and Law departments, and she is currently the policy director at Housing Alliance Delaware. Amy Walls, a resident of Seaford, is a principal at Discover Bank. In her role, she provides investments, loans, and philanthropic investments to support affordable housing and other community needs that help the low and moderate income community. Her team's portfolio is strongly weighted towards affordable housing and has under management of over $200 million of mortgage-backed securities to support low and moderate income homeownership in Delaware, purchased in partnership with Delaware State Housing Authority's mortgage program. Over $30 million in loans to affordable multifamily rental housing developments in Delaware and over $250 million in low-income tax credit investments. Thus far in 2021, Discover has granted over $500,000 to specifically support affordable housing initiatives in Delaware. That's what I have. If anyone has any questions.
They both agreed to serve?
They have, as well as Bill from Economic Development.
Any questions for council? Are we going to entertain a vote on this morning to ratify this advisory board, or are we just going to move forward with it?
I don't think it's necessary. You don't have a motion for consideration.
I do not.
I think the recommendation was to bring it forward in this nature and make sure that there's no concerns, and if you haven't heard any concerns, then task Brandy with moving on to the next steps, and we'll get started next year.
I don't have any concerns. It sounds pretty good to me.
Okay. Good. Okay. Well, please let me know if you have any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brandy. We're now time for our 10:30 scheduled public hearing. Mr. Moore.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. President. This is time for public hearing on amendments to the Sussex County Code to include a new article 7 Roman numeral real property tax credits for disabled veterans. There will be a brief presentation by Gina Jennings, our finance director. Subsequent to that, There will be an opportunity for any of the council members to ask questions, and then after that, any member of the public that's here today is free to participate and ask questions or comment. After that, the council can possibly take action today. Ms. Jennings?
Thank you, Mr. Moore. As stated in the presentation in October, the ordinance would exempt veterans with 100% disability rating from the county property taxes if they qualify for the state's Veteran Disability Program. According to the National Center for Veterans Analysis and Statistics, August 2021 report, there were 516 individuals who may qualify in Sussex County. It is estimated to cost the county $44,000 annually. This ordinance complements House Bill 214 with House Amendment 1 that passed the General Assembly on June 30, 2021 and was signed by Governor Carney on August 10, 2021. The state's legislation authorized school districts, not including VOTEC schools, to provide 100% credit against school taxes for disabled veterans that meet the definition of qualified persons owning qualified property. The state's legislation did not exempt veterans from the county portion of the property tax bill. Therefore, this ordinance would provide that exemption. And I could turn it back over to Mr. Moore to conduct the public hearing.
Yes, thank you. Are there any questions from council? If not, is there any member of the public that would like to comment on this proposed ordinance? Is there any member of the public in chambers that would like to comment? Seeing none, operator, can you check to see if there's anyone listening remotely that would like to opine on this matter?
At this time, there is no one on the line.
Thank you, operator. Mr. President, this time we can close the public hearing on this matter. If council desires, they can close public record.
We'll close the public hearing. It's okay with council. Close public record. Ask Mr. Morgan a short title.
Thank you, Mr. President. An ordinance to amend the Sussex County Code to include a new Article 7 Roman numeral, real property tax credit for disabled veterans under Part 2 Roman numeral general legislation, taxation section 103-43 through 103-47 to establish a real property value-based tax credit for totally disabled veterans who are residents of Sussex County and who meet eligibility criteria under the State of Delaware Disabled Veteran School Tax Credit pursuant to 14 Del Code 1917.
Thank you, sir. Pleasure, Council.
So moved.
Motion, Mr. Schaefer.
Second.
Second, Mr. Hudson. Any questions on the motion? We're going to take the vote. Mr. Schaefer.
Yes.
Mrs. Green.
Yes.
Mr. Hudson.
Yes.
Mr. Riley.
Yeah, I agree with this. To me, this is just a moral thing to do. When you send men off to war and women off to war and they come back injured 100%, it's absolutely the right thing to do. So my vote's yes.
I'm also going to vote yes. I certainly think this is maybe the least we can do for these people. So,
Mr. President, just one comment, and hopefully the press will print it. The deadline for applying is April 30th.
That's correct, yes.
So just hopefully the paper will print that. So, you know, it sounds like a good ways away, but it'll be here
before we
know it. So
good point.
Please apply before April 30th.
So with that motion carried, next thing, Mr. Medlars. Ellendale Sewer and Water Operations Agreement.
Good morning, Mr. President. Good morning, council members. I'm glad to be here with this interesting opportunity for us and for the town. As you know, many times the engineering department brings forward initiatives which originate either with Ms. Jennings and I or on the third floor. This one is a town initiative. So the town approached the county engineering department about that. And they have, which triggered it, there's a number of annexations in front of the town council. And you may, Ms. Green probably knows that. But so they were interested in making a reciprocal that if they consider an annexation, if and when becomes contiguous with the sewer or water district, they would have to come in, and vice versa. If it becomes contiguous with the town under the town charter, they would have to annex. So we have similar arrangements with Greenwood and Seaford. So the president and I strongly support that, if I may say that, Mr. President.
You're fine.
Then we conveyed that to the town. The town attorney, Mr. Eliason, drafted up the initial draft. At that point, the soon-to-be president of council, Mr. Moore, will support it using the ARPA funds to doing a water loop in the town, with using that plus leftover funds from the project, which we have under the state funding. And that was added to this. So when I appeared before council, it was very comprehensive, very nice discussion. And the town council fully supported it. Last Thursday was signed, and Ms. Hughes delivered a signed copy. Should be available to the president to sign if approved today. So we have a requested motion to approve the agreement as
Why don't you read your motion? Was it got any questions?
Be it removed based upon the recommendation of the Sussex County Engineering and Finance Departments that the Sussex County Council approve the Ellendale Sewer and Water Operations Agreement between Sussex County and the Town of Ellendale as presented.
Pleasure, Council.
So moved.
Motion, Mr. Schaefer.
Second.
Second, Mrs. Green. Questions on the motion? Questions on the motion? We'll take the vote. Mr. Schaefer?
Yes.
Mrs. Green?
Yes.
Mr. Hudson?
Yes.
Mr. Riley?
Yes.
I will. Yes. Motion carries. Sir. Thank you. Mr. Whitehouse. Update and discussion related to subdivision application number 2006-73, the Vines of Sandfield.
Good morning, Mr. President, members of council. In your paperless packets today, I have included a short memo. I have a copy of some of the appendices to that just to show council while I provide a brief overview. And within that memo, I provided a short background to the subdivision along with an update of where matters currently sit in terms of building permits. And then it was my plan to just run through and then answer any questions, Council.
Yes, that'd be good.
So this is a, if I actually call up the county's land use map. So this is an existing previously approved 400 lot subdivision located south of Hough Road, which is Sussex County Route 252. It was approved and it was applied for in 2006 as a major subdivision application for the subdivision of 261 acres into 400 lots. The subdivision went through the Planning and Zoning Commission review process. It was reviewed by staff and it was reported to the Planning and Zoning Commission. And then at Thursday, August 20th of 2008, some 2 years later, the commission approved the preliminary subdivision plat for the major subdivision, the reference is 2006-73, subject to those 15 conditions of approval, which became part of the final site plan, which was then subsequently reviewed. Condition M, most importantly, condition M of the conditions of approval stated that within 2 years of the issuance of the first residential building permits, the developer shall construct all of the residential amenities. Then more than 2 years had passed from the commencement of the development, and it was drawn to the staff's attention that the amenities had still not been developed. The applicant, the developer, reached out to the county and requested that the commission consider the request to revise the conditions of approval to change the trigger. The basis for this request was based upon a general note which was shown on the phasing plan, and the note states that construction of the amenities was intended to be completed by the issuance of the 136 building permit. So originally, the 2 years from the first commencement of the first building permit, which was approximately December of 2018, 2 years had passed and the amenities had still not been delivered, but it was requested to change it to the 136 building permit. This was reported to Planning and Zoning Commission at their meeting in May of this year. And at the meeting of May 13th of this year, the Commission approved the revision to Condition M. And the Condition M now states that amenities shall commence within 6 months from the Planning and Zoning Commission date of May 13th, 2021, and shall be completed within 18 months of said Commission date, or before the issuance of the 136 building permit, whichever occurs first. So what that means is that based upon the developer informing the commission that they were to be underway within 6 months, the commission approved the request to change the trigger to 18 months from the commencement date or the 136 building permit, whichever of those comes first. So based upon that, I wanted to provide a short update on where we're at in terms of building permitting, and then I wanted to just talk briefly about the amenities themselves. So in Council's packet, we provided an overview. We now have the ability to show you how the building permits have been applied for, how they've been issued, and how they've been CO'd. So within the development, there have been 99 building permits that have been applied for dwelling houses within the subdivision. And of those 99 applications for building permits, 96 of these have actually been issued. And three of those are currently pending. And of those 96 issued building permits, 63 of those have been issued with certificates of occupancy. So the circles are the building permits, the orange squares are those that are CO'd, and the blue diamonds are those building permits that are pending. So we can see we've not exceeded the 136 building permit threshold, but as of this week, we are past the six-month threshold for commencement. So on Friday, when I prepared this memo, I reached out to the developer, and I received a response from Mr. Spazzato, who has offered to speak to council at a future meeting, should that be requested. But they're stating that they, as of last week, they have broken ground. The implementation of the silt fence has been installed into the area to be disturbed, and the developer is looking to move dirt and trees within 2 to 3 weeks. And this is an email dated Friday of last week. They've informed us the name of the builder of the clubhouse. I can confirm that we have not received a building permit application for the clubhouse as of Friday. And I'm told that a building permit application is to be pulled, but as of today, it has not been pulled. So where there has been, they've broken ground and commenced work on site for implementation, but they haven't yet pulled a building permit. But we are told that they are going to comply. So turning to the triggers, they have 18 months from commencement on site to deliver the clubhouse or the implementation of 136 building permits, which we're not quite there. Very briefly, I wanted to talk about the design and size of the subdivision, because I understand, and this came up during conversations that staff have had with interested parties. The original, so this is the clubhouse as it's approved today. And it was, the siting of the clubhouse has not changed throughout the review process. So the siting and location of the clubhouse went through Planning and Zoning Commission, was approved at their meeting of December 14th of 2017. Subsequent to that, the commission then saw a separate site plan for the amenities, which showed a two-story clubhouse with 9,987 square feet of floor area, which was reviewed and approved by the commission in February of 2018. And then subsequent to that, staff issued a final site plan in October of 2018 for the 9,987 square feet of floor area. Since that time, we've received a request to revise plan approval, and this is the plan that we've received. And this was received in October of this year, and the request was to administratively approve a reduction down to 6,600 square feet.
Almost in half?
It's a reduction of about 3,300 square feet.
About a third. Well, at least a third, yeah.
Correct. So, and the reason for that is, and the annotation is not shown on this drawing, but I have a copy of the previously approved drawing. They've removed a walkout in the lower level. Now, staff did question this prior to stamping and reviewing the plan to question what the reason for the change is. My understanding is that it is a financial reason that the developer has proffered as to why they're making the request. As the plan does not change the clubhouse siting or size or the envelope of the building, and all of the amenities are unchanged, including the tennis courts and bocce ball, staff couldn't find a conflict with the zoning code for the change in the plan. The parking still complies with code, lighting complies with code, building siting complies with code, including setbacks. Although there's a reduction in floor area, the conditions of approval for the subdivision have been complied with. I understand there's some concern in relation to this change between occupiers of the subdivision and the developer in relation to what folks were expecting when they bought into this subdivision, when they moved in. So there would appear to be a contractual dispute between some residents and the developer. But the question before staff is whether the revised site plan conflicted with the conditions of approval or the zoning code, which it did not.
So what did you say was the change in the usable square footage of walkout?
The note on the previous plan for the 9,987 square feet, it says walk out at lower level, and it's on the east side where the deck is shown on this drawing facing the pool. And I have a copy of that drawing that I can circulate to council today. So this is a copy of the March 2018 drawing. The footprint is the same, everything is the same except for the annotation for the clubhouse, which went from two-story to one-story, and the walkout has been removed and the floor area has been reduced. So.
For what? So we approved, somebody approved this plan.
Correct.
With, whatever it was, 9,000 some square feet.
Correct.
Why would we approve a plan less than that?
So in this case, we reached out to the developer to ask the question, what is driving the change? So it was a question that, not necessarily that it was something that we desired to approve. It was something that there was no, if there's no conflict with the zoning code in terms of the arrangement of the site, the question is, what would be the basis for denial in planning and zoning terms? It is different and it is a reduction, but as there was no conflict with the code and the developer seemingly had the authority to request this change, staff couldn't see a conflict to resist it. So it's been approved as compliant with the zoning code, but I would point out that if the developer has a contractual relationship with developers with residents moving in to deliver a clubhouse of a specified size, this doesn't override. So the fact that it's been found to be compliant with the zoning code in terms of its setbacks, its siting, its lighting and parking, this wouldn't override any existing agreement between developer and residents. This is without prejudice to any legal matters out there between developer and residents.
Are you suggesting then that future approvals should have some language that clubhouse or amenity not be under a certain square footage?
It's possible. The commission has, in certain circumstances, on very large developments, has explored such wording to require in the conditions the clubhouse shall be this specified size. There's currently nothing in the zoning code that links number of units to clubhouse size, but in some cases it has become necessary to do that. There is no condition here on this particular subdivision to do that in this case, but it could be something that staff explore with the commission to explore whether it's necessary to start doing that in future cases to prevent further recurrences of this.
So if I've heard what you said, the request of the developer to make this a smaller size, there's nothing in our code or ordinances that allows us to turn that down.
Correct.
And if I am a homeowner in this development and I bought my property and they had told me it was going to be X number square feet clubhouse, my recourse is to enter a lawsuit.
Correct.
You're saying that because they didn't fulfill the contract.
Correct.
Mr. Moore, is that?
Yeah, there would be the potential for a lawsuit in that case for, you know, whether it's false advertising or that false advertising leading to the inducement to enter into a contract. Question is whether or not that survives the contract and goes in after the closing occurs. That's difficult. That is definitely a potential cause of action. But again, as all of you know, when that's passed by council, public naturally has a view, well, that was on the plan, which you're alluding to. So, you know, maybe the council and planning zoning needs to look at, should there be some kind of minimal square footages on these kind of amenities placed in the future, you know, so you don't hit this.
Or should it be something that you can't change it?
Right. Absolutely.
Once you put it on, you know,
yes.
On that. I mean, obviously, if it meets if our current code, is our current code. If it meets that code, you have no reason, legal reason, to deny it. That's one thing.
Yeah.
But I guess my question would be, and maybe we need to have a little more thought and research. Is there anything that legally we as the council can require them to build what was on the first site plan of 9,000 some square feet, two-story building? I guess that's what it was. Whatever you said it was.
Right.
Is there some way to require that to occur?
Right.
Or is there not? If there isn't, then certainly the opportunity of the landowners in there, the people that bought the dwelling, would be hopefully that was in a contract and it called out certain things and they could then enter a lawsuit. But I think we need to at least take this as a learning lesson and say, how can this not happen again?
That's got to be fixed.
And hopefully there's some way we can forget, make it not happen now, but I don't know for a fact, but maybe we can have that research legally from your
sure.
department and see what you come up with.
We definitely will.
I don't think anybody would look forward to purchasing something that was sold to you, and I would say even the salesperson told you this is what you're going to get,
mm-hmm.
and it's not what you got. That is not a pleasant experience. It wouldn't be for me. I'm sure nobody up here. So maybe we can do a little more research on this and see, because they haven't built anything yet, obviously.
Correct.
to see if there's some reason that this council could say, time out. Legally, you can't, you know. And if not, then obviously the alternative to the property owners is they have to enter a lawsuit.
Yeah.
So, any questions, council? Questions, comments?
I have a question.
Mr. Hudson.
You talked about, they said they've been breaking ground. What do they mean by breaking ground? Do you have...
So the email, I'm happy to share the email that I've received from Mr. Spazzato on Friday. I reached out to inform him that this was going to be presented to County Council, and his response on Friday afternoon is, Bunting and Murray broke ground yesterday, so this is Thursday of last week. Implementation of silt fence has been installed to area to be disturbed. Looking to move dirt trees in 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay.
So this suggests to me that, at a minimum, we can expect to see a silt fence.
So the silt fence means they've broken ground?
It's, to me, no. And we do not,
exactly.
And we do not have a building permit.
And they're breaking ground without a building permit. So is the cart in front of the horse here, or is it just they're not doing anything?
So there are two options here. As we are beyond the 6 months, the condition of approval arguably has not been complied with because we've not been furnished with a building permit application, yet alone being given time to review the building permit and go through and work with the applicant to ensure that the building permit is in compliance. There is scope for us to require the developer to absolutely move within that time frame. So we're told that we will be receiving a building permit, but we can take steps to prompt the developer to ensure that they do that.
Okay, so if he comes in today for a building permit, and with all the stuff you have to go through them with on this type of building, it's not just a home. How long do you think it is before the building permit's issued if you came in today?
So it could take 3 to 4 weeks because it has to go through commercial plan review.
That is exactly my point.
But I will say this, the clock on the 18-month timeline for implementation and completion is still ticking during that period. So the 18 months doesn't start the moment they pull the building permit or the moment the building permit is issued. The clock is ticking now because they stated that they have broken ground. So.
Okay, but can they move dirt and tear down trees without the building permit?
We would always take the view that as long as a building permit is in and is being pending, then preparatory works on site could be undertaken in preparation of commencement, especially if those works are in the exact same location that the building permit's been pulled on. We would normally allow site work to start while we're getting the building permit for above ground works ready.
So. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is it appropriate for staff to call and ask when they propose to submit the building permit application?
Sure. I will likely be having a meeting with this developer in the extreme near future. He's currently out of town, but as soon as he returns back to Suscor County, I will be in contact.
And we can report back to the homeowners?
Sure. I'm happy to. If anyone wishes to give me a call in about a week's time, I will know a great deal more than I currently do. So.
Any more questions of council?
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you for the update. And
thank
Mr.
you.
Moore, if you would do some research and see if there is any kind of legal standing we have to go back and say, time out. Hear what you said. You're on your first plans. We're going to build it. Okay. Thanks, Jamie. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Old business.
I have just one item of old business today, Mr. President, and that's conditional use number 2262, filed on behalf of Matthew Heaty. Council may remember this. It's a conditional use application for multi-family dwellings, 4 units, located northeast of Plantations Road on the southeast side of Postal Lane, which is Sussex County Rec 283. County Council held a public hearing on the application at its meeting of October 11th of this year, and at the conclusion of that public hearing, Council deferred action on the application to enable the receipt of a recommendation from the Planning and Zoning Commission, and then following that, the Planning and Zoning Commission made their recommendation to approve the conditional use application at their meeting of October 13th. This was reported to Council on October 19th, an update was provided, and Council left the record open until the close of business until 4:30 p.m. on Monday, October 25th, for the receipt of additional public comments. I can confirm that we have received no additional comments, and the record is closed on that.
Okay. Any questions, Council, comments? Mr. Moore, will you read the short title, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. An ordinance grant a conditional use of land in an AR1 agricultural residential district for multifamily dwellings, 4 units, to be located on a certain parcel of land lying and being in Lewis and Rehoboth 100, Sussex County, containing 1.25 acres, more or less, for the reasons given by planning zoning numbered 1 through 6, with conditions 7A through L.
Pleasure, Council. Pleasure of council.
I'll move for adoption.
Motion to adopt. Have we have a second?
Second,
Mr. Hudson. Any questions on the motion? We'll take the vote. Mr. Schaefer.
I will vote yes based on the recommendations of planning and zoning, and I want to point out that the applicant's attorney did explain thoroughly how this particular application was permitted in an AR1 district, and I was satisfied with his answer to that question, and again, I'll vote yes.
Mrs. Green?
Based on the recommendation from planning and zoning, I'll vote yes.
I also vote yes based on the reasons given by planning and zoning.
I too vote yes based on planning and zoning's reasons and conditions.
I also agree with the reasons and conditions of planning and zoning, and I will vote yes. Motion carried. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Ms. Jennings, grant requests.
Thank you, Mr. President. The first grant request is Grace and Mercy Ministries is requesting $3,000 for their community Thanksgiving dinner in Greenwood. The last grant awarded this organization was $5,000 in May of 2021 for summer youth camp expenses. Last grant for this event was $3,000, which was $1,000 each from Mr. Burton, Mr. Riley, and Mr. Vincent. Ms. Green placed on the agenda.
Ms. Green.
I will put $1,000 towards the expenses of the Thanksgiving dinner from my council money.
Motion, Mrs. Green.
I will offer $1,000 from the third district.
Okay, yeah. So motion, Mrs. Green, second, Mr. Schaefer. Anybody else? Everybody's good, okay. We have a motion, Mrs. Green, second, Mr. Schaefer, to grant $2,000 to Grace and Mercy Ministries for community Thanksgiving dinner, being $1,000 from Mrs. Green's council bank account and $1,000 from Mr. Schaefer's council bank account. Questions on the motion? We'll take the vote. Mr. Schaefer?
Yes.
Mrs. Green?
Yes.
Mr. Hudson?
Yes.
Mr. Riley?
Yes.
I vote yes. Motion carried. Next.
Okay, the next one is Western Sussex Chamber of Commerce is requesting $2,000 on behalf of the Downtown Seaford Association for their annual Seaford Christmas Parade. Last grant awarded this organization was $1,000 for their Bike and Brew Tour. The last grant for the event was $500 in 2019 from Mr. Vincent. Mr. Vincent placed on the agenda.
Somebody make the motion to grant $1,000 to my council bank account for this.
I will do that.
Motion, Mr. Hudson. Second, Mr. Schaefer. Questions on the motion? Motion is to grant $1,000 to Western Sussex Chamber of Commerce for the Downtown Seaford Association Christmas Parade from my council bank account. We'll take the vote, Mr. Schaefer.
Yes.
Mrs. Green?
Yes.
Mr. Hudson?
Yes.
Mr. Riley?
Yes.
I vote yes. Motion carried. Mr. Moore?
Yes, we have one, Mr. President. It's in Mr. Hudson's district. An ordinance grant a conditional use of land in an AR1 agricultural residential district for a food truck to be located on a certain parcel of land lying and being in Indian River 100, Sussex County, containing 0.235 acres, more or less.
I will introduce.
Mr. Hudson introduced it.
That is all.
Council member comments. Council member comments. Anyone? Okay, entertain a motion to go to executive session for pending potential litigation, land acquisition, and personnel.
So moved.
Motion, Mr. Hudson.
Second.
Second, Mrs. Green. Question on the motion. We'll take the vote. Mr. Schaefer?
Yes.
Mrs. Green?
Yes.
Mr. Hudson?
Yes.
Mr. Riley?
Yes.
I vote yes. We're now in executive session for pending potential litigation, land acquisition, and personnel.